Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America in this honorable court.
Welcome back to Criminal Law Department Presents CAF Chats. I am Major Andrew Britt, and today I'm joined by
Major Cece Bernstein.
Welcome, Cece. It's great to have you on the program. So today we're going to be discussing United States versus Downham. It's a case out of the Army involving wrongful use of cocaine and more questions about how courts of criminal appeals are supposed to conduct their factual sufficiency analysis.
We'll also be discussing how the CAF is attempting to clarify its own precedent regarding the government's burden in what we colloquially call a cocaine pop hot. In this case, the Army Court of Criminal Appeals found Captain Ross Downham's conviction by a panel of officers at a general court-martial to be legally and factually insufficient, where the government introduced expert testimony about a positive urinalysis test, but not the printed-out results from the test. The majority affirmed at CAF on the factual sufficiency determination, but the dissent also gives some additional context for practitioners, so you'll want to stick around until the end for the final takeaways.
Well, before we get into CAF's decision, can you get us started with the background and procedural history on the case?
Sure thing. At a general court-martial, Captain Downham was charged with the wrongful use of cocaine under Article 112 Alpha UCMJ. The government's case relied heavily on the testimony of an expert in forensic toxicology and drug testing, a Dr. C.O.
And what did Dr. C.O. testify about?
She testified that although she did not test Captain Downham's sample, she had reviewed the urinalysis report and, based on that review, opined that the urine sample tested positive for a metabolite of cocaine. She was able to recite the specific measurement. However, the government never actually offered the physical machine-generated urinalysis results into evidence.
And the fact that they are machine-generated matters because it makes them admissible as non-testimonial business records under Emory 8036, right?
Exactly. The Army Court specifically points out that such records are admissible and, indeed, regularly admitted in cases like these. Since the test results were never admitted, the panel heard the expert's interpretation but didn't see the underlying data she was interpreting.
So, in a case like this, where the government essentially is relying on the presence of a controlled substance in Downham's system to prove its case, they normally would have to use an expert to interpret the lab results. Interestingly, though, the defense did not object to the facts introduced through Dr. CO's testimony, which means that the panel could consider it all substantively. They had a few other witnesses, and apparently the government was thorough on chain of custody, but Dr. CO's testimony was the only evidence to establish that Downham used cocaine. Oddly, the government had the paper with the lab results in their possession, but they chose not to try to admit it. Cece, can you talk about the defense case?
The accused took the stand and testified that he never ever in his whole life would have even possibly intentionally ingested cocaine. He gave a theory that there was an occasion when his drink at a bar may have been spiked with cocaine. Despite this, the officer panel found him guilty. Although it wasn't his burden to prove that he didn't knowingly ingest cocaine, it was the government's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he did.
So, for wrongful use of cocaine under Article 112 Alpha, the government has two elements to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. First, that Downham used cocaine, and second, that Downham's use of that cocaine was wrongful. The fact that the metabolite showed up in the urinalysis establishes that he used cocaine. If Downham denied ever knowing using cocaine and he was still convicted at trial, then what evidence did the government offer to prove that second element?
The ACCA had the same question. Ironically, the defense called two fact witnesses that undermined his testimony. One denied that Captain Downham ever expressed concerns that his drink may have been spiked, and the other testified that Captain Downham knew his test would be positive for cocaine before the results were available.
That's not good. And the panel gets to consider all the evidence for whatever it's relevant to. The fact that it came in from the defense doesn't stop them from using it against him.
Correct. But for the government's part, they relied on the permissive inference to argue wrongfulness.
And what's that permissive inference?
The permissive or permissible inference is an instruction given by the military judge that allows the fact finder to infer wrongful use from the existence of a positive urinalysis. Inferring an element may seem like it lowers the government's burden to prove that element beyond a reasonable doubt, but not really. A mens rea is notoriously hard to prove and often requires inferences or circumstantial evidence because a trial is inherently unable to be present in the mind of the actor at the time of the event. So case law has established factors that military judges should consider when determining whether to instruct the panel on a permissible inference of wrongfulness.
And so in this case, the judge found that those factors were met?
Yes, and the defense did not object to the instruction.
And Downham was convicted, which brings us to the service court. So the Army Court reversed the conviction, finding the evidence was both legally and factually insufficient. The court focused on Dr. Seo's expert testimony in the absence of the underlying urinalysis results. Of note, though, the Army Court stated that the expert's testimony lacked relevance, beyond stating the concentration level of the cocaine metabolite in the sample. Which then brings us to CAF's review. So TJAG certified three issues for review. Cece, can you break those down for us?
Absolutely. The three issues were, first, whether the Army Court erred in its legal sufficiency analysis by holding that case law, specifically United States v. Campbell, requires not just expert testimony, but also the admission of the underlying paper urinalysis results. Second, whether the Army Court erred by holding that unobjected to expert testimony was irrelevant without those paper results. And third, whether the Army Court failed to conduct a proper factual sufficiency analysis under Article 66.
CAF first addresses the relevance question, then the Army Court's factual sufficiency review. Based on its resolution of the factual sufficiency question, the majority moots the legal sufficiency question. Taking them in the same order, how did CAF analyze the Army Court's determination that the expert's testimony lacked relevance?
CAF disagreed with the idea that the ACA found the testimony completely irrelevant under MRE 401. If the ACA had found the testimony truly not relevant, it would have been inadmissible. The court couldn't have considered it, and the analysis would have stopped there.
Okay, then what did the Army Court actually mean when it said that the expert testimony lacked relevance?
CAF concluded that the ACA inartfully used the word relevance, and that the analysis showed ACA found that Dr. CO's testimony provided little probative value without the underlying test results to back it up. The ACA was focused on whether the government had proven the element of wrongfulness.
Which we discussed can be established through permissive inference. What's the import of the Army Court determining the expert testimony had little probative value?
To get that inference, the expert testimony needs to establish key facts about the test. That the metabolite isn't naturally produced by the body or any other substance, that the cutoff levels are high enough to discount unknowing ingestion, and that the testing method was reliable. These factors come from Campbell, and they are not necessarily exclusive. The inference can also be triggered by other evidence if it can explain, with equivalent persuasiveness, the underlying scientific methodology and the significance of the test results. Here, the ACA found Dr. CO's testimony offered virtually no information about the test itself. It was just a conclusion on the concentration level without the supporting data.
Without the permissive inference to support the wrongfulness finding, the Army Court finds Downham's conviction to be factually insufficient. However, in the third certified issue, the government asserted that the Army Court applied the wrong standard of review in conducting its factual sufficiency analysis. There are a few issues to unpack here. First, CAF reviews a CCA's factual sufficiency determination by examining whether the CCA applied correct legal principles. In the fiscal year 21 NDAA, Congress changed Article 66 by modifying the authority of CCAs to conduct a factual sufficiency review. Prior to that change, CAF precedent used the term de novo for the standard of review. In Harvey, CAF explained how the new factual sufficiency review authority should be applied, but it declined to give a term for what that standard of review should be called. The Army Court decided Downham before the Harvey decision came out. In the absence of Harvey's guidance, the Army Court stated that the standard of review under the new factual sufficiency test is de novo, with acknowledgement of the new statutory language at issue.
Right. The ECA quoted the language from Article 66 that mandates appropriate deference to the fact that the trial court saw and heard the witnesses and other evidence. This new language appears contrary to a de novo review, which the government argued, according to the Black Law's definition, means no deference is given to the trial court. This was a bit tricky and is still probably not completely settled, because even the old factual sufficiency standard was not fully de novo, even though that's how CAF labeled it.
Yes, the old standard tempered the CCA's review of the facts by requiring them to recognize that the trial court saw and heard the witnesses. I think the point that CAF is getting at here is that the name given to the standard is not as important as following the proper procedures. So to that end, CAF instructs that going forward, the service court should cite Harvey and follow its guidance. Okay, so Cece, what does CAF make of the government's issue with the Army Court calling it de novo here?
CAF said it was an open question on whether or not ACCA applied the correct principles under Harvey. However, they could still resolve the issue because even if the standard was misapplied, the error was harmless. CAF pointed out that ACCA's decision didn't turn on the credibility of the witnesses. It turned on the government's failure to meet its burden of proof. So even if ACCA got the standard wrong, it did not prejudice the government's case because ACCA still considered all the evidence the government offered and concluded it just wasn't enough to meet the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
So ultimately, the CAF affirms, since the Army Court assigned little weight to the expert testimony and it did not reversibly err in how it reached this conclusion, the Army Court was within its authority to set aside Downham's conviction as factually insufficient. This moots the first certified issue about legal sufficiency, so CAF does not reach this question. But this was not a unanimous decision. It was a 3-2 split.
That's right. Judge Hardy wrote for the majority, Judge Sparks and Johnson dissented, and they would have remanded the case. They had a less charitable view on ACCA's opinion, believing ACCA did improperly disregard Dr. CO's testimony as irrelevant under MRE 401. The dissent argued that the permissive inference of wrongfulness does not require the paper results to be in evidence. They cited another case, United States versus Green, to argue that as long as the expert testimony is deemed admissible by the judge, the government can rely on it to prove its case. The dissent felt that by creating a requirement for the paper results, ACCA was failing to apply correct legal principles. They argued the case should be sent back to ACCA for clarification.
There's certainly a disagreement about applicable precedent in this case. The dissent views Green as modifying the legal landscape from the Campbell decisions, but the majority, in footnote 3, explicitly rejects that interpretation that Green replaced the Campbell factors regarding permissive inferences. As we turn to takeaways, an important consideration for anyone handling a wrongful use case is to review both Campbell decisions and Green. It's an interesting set of cases. The second Campbell is a decision on reconsideration of the first, where CAF offered further guidance on its holding on permissive inferences. Campbell specifically dealt with novel scientific methods. In Green, CAF discusses distinctions between novel and proven scientific methods, as well as the Daubert standard and the permissive inference standard. Even after multiple attempts to clarify these issues, they are admittedly still a bit muddied. Both tests concern reliability, but I think the important distinction for practitioners is that Daubert controls admissibility, while the Campbell factors trigger the inference. Cece, what other takeaways do we have from this case for our listeners?
I think for the government, the key takeaway is don't take risks. While you can try to prove a case with just expert testimony, you run the significant risk of an appellate court finding the evidence factually insufficient. The safest bet is always to admit the underlying urinalysis results as business records to support the expert's conclusions. And it's better for a panel, too. Even if they don't know exactly what they're looking at, having something to look at helps anchor the expert testimony when they're discussing during deliberations.
Definitely. Government counsel should also be mindful that the lab results are not the exclusive means of proving the wrongfulness element. So think through the totality of all available evidence and theories of proof. What do we have for the defense?
For defense counsel, the takeaway is to be vigilant. Object to a lack of foundation or to the permissive inference instructions if the government only offers expert testimony without the underlying data. This case shows that even if evidence is admitted, you can still win by arguing it's factually insufficient to sustain a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. Also, be prepared to make that 917 motion. We didn't get into it here, but the defense counsel did make a mid-trial motion alleging the evidence was insufficient to sustain a conviction. This case offers some additional support for that argument. It really highlights the difference between admissibility and sufficiency. Just because evidence comes in doesn't mean it's strong enough to carry the government's burden. This case is a stark reminder that they have to present a complete and convincing package of evidence.
Note that CAF does cabin its opinion to a narrow holding, though, stating that their decision signifies nothing more than that the ACCA did not abuse its discretion in performing its factual sufficiency analysis. So be cautious of trying to extend the opinion too far. For appellate practitioners, though, remember that you now have additional guidance on how to properly articulate that new factual sufficiency standard of review in your briefs. Okay, is there anything else we missed on this case?
No, I think that about covers it.
Well, thank you, Cece, for joining me today, and thank you to our listeners for tuning in. See you next time for another episode of CAF Chats.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General's or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. The court will stand in recess until further order of the court.